1 Corinthians, Paul says, "For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, you are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ." In this podcast, we explore those who went the wrong way. We examine why it happened, how it happened, and who it happened to. But most importantly, we always ask the question, could it happen to us?
Thanks for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Before we begin, we want to be clear, the opinions that we present are ours alone and do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of our respective churches or employers. Now, let's begin.
Well, hello, Brian. We are back again. Tonight, we are here to talk about Heaven's Gate.
Oh, good evening, Matt. It has been, it's been a long month. I feel like it's been forever since we've done one of these episodes, since we took that July and kind of took a short episode and did a little bit of recap and review. But I think it gave us plenty of time to do some good studying here. There's a lot of information.
You know, I thought this would be a kind of a quick one too, but the more we dove into it, the more there is to it. And
yeah,
there's a lot to this group. And as we've discovered, like we've discovered with some of these other cults, they're not all gone.
Right.
There's
still a contingent of people out there. I'm assuming that are active.
And you know, some of the other groups we've talked about how we have not much sympathy, but we have a little bit of thought that, hey, maybe we could have maybe fallen for something like this, or we sort of understand how they got to where they got some of it. But this one, it's so far off the wall, I'm nowhere near where they're at.
Well, you see, I was going to say, when we get to the theology, right, I've got a point to make that I think you're going to be like, oh, wait a second. Because a lot of what these guys were teaching, right, was just a misapplied truth, right? So when we get to that, that ought to be fun.
Okay. Well, let's, as we try to do on this show here, we try to start from the beginning. So let's start from the beginning here. Let's see where we start. So we're talking about the Heaven's Gate cult, and that starts off with two individuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bonnie Nettles,
yep.
And Marshall Applewhite.
Marshall, yep.
Mm-hmm. We were discussing earlier about what his first name was. Now, they had a few other names over the years. They called themselves Bo and Pete.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was another name before they got the final name, wasn't there?
I'm
just trying to remember if they were Alpha and Omega or not, but they were definitely Bo and Pete. And then later,
I don't think that was...
they went with T and Doe. And I know what everybody's thinking when I say T and Doe. Doe, a deer, a female deer. Ray, a drop of falling sun. Take it, Brian.
Oh, dear. No. Nope.
Oh, that's not how the song goes. But everybody's thinking about the Sound of Music. Y'all, I'm married to a band director. The Sound of Music is canon in our home. And actually, you know, that might be a podcast to do later. I don't know how that it somewhat qualifies. We'll talk about that later. There's a long history has to do with that family.
Yeah,
but anyways, it does come from the movie. It is said that Bonnie Nettles, it was her favorite movie. And so they thought the T and Doe thing fit. As a matter of fact, this would be a good place for us to insert some audio if we were going to insert some audio. This would be a good place to insert a small clip of the Heaven's Gate version of that song where they sing about T and Doe.
The name of this song is When You Know T and Doe by the Pipes.
Wasn't that an awesome audio clip? That was something. Their special rendition there was wow. That's all I can say about that. Just wow.
I don't even know what to say.
So they ended up with the names T and Doe.
Okay.
There. So how did they recruit their followers? How did this get started with that?
I was gonna say I think stepping back a little bit further into the history, right?
Like how they met or something.
Right. You know, I mean, we need to give them the full treatment, right? Nettles and Applewhite met in Houston or Austin.
I think it was Houston.
If I remember right. And she, Nettles, was very, very heavily involved with the New Age movements, right? She fell into metaphysics and astrology. She talked about receiving assistance from spiritual beings regarding various pieces of astrology. She's very open about these things. She was... at one point, a member of the Houston branch of the Theosophical Society. So she was a follower of Helena Blavatsky, who was very deep into spiritualistic occult practices, right? And so she was kind of always very on the edge of New Age, right? Whatever was going on, she was involved in it, right? So it's strange when you hear that she and Applewhite kind of met up and became friends, because his father was a Presbyterian pastor. Kind of the complete opposite of the theosophical, occultic, astrology, metaphysical spirituality, right? So Applewhite had a bit more of a... stable Christian heritage, right? For the most part, he was in the Presbyterian church, went to a Presbyterian college, finally dropped out of that school and went to a music school in Colorado, where he finished up his master's degree. And then he went and he served as a choir director at a big Houston church, big Episcopal Houston church. So he was kind of always right in the middle of the church. And then they met in 1972. and immediately became partners in teaching various spiritualities.
Let's talk about how they met.
Yeah.
So he was actually a college professor right before they met and had recently lost his job because he was caught having an affair with a male student. And so although he had this background in Presbyterianism, he obviously struggled with homosexuality. And it was a struggle to him and something that didn't reconcile with his faith, obviously. And he was married, so there's a problem there. And there's some controversy with how they met. They met at a hospital. She was a nurse, right, and he was a patient. Was it because he was in there for mental reasons? That's debated. Current and former members of the group say it was not because he was in there for mental reasons. They say he had some physical ailments that he was dealing with. Some former members and some press have said it was because of mental reasons. But as we know with the HIPAA laws and stuff, there's no telling for sure why he was in that hospital. Right. Don't know that that exactly matters, but his life was falling apart at the time. Mm-hmm. He was, for all intents and purposes, a very intelligent man. But the fundamentals of his life was falling apart. As you mentioned, his spiritual upbringing, his family life, everything was falling apart when he met Bonnie Nettles.
Right.
And she had a drastic influence on him. And when she met him, she told him that there was something, there was some connection between them. And he believed that. And so they set out together to explore what that connection was. Interesting enough, they even admit that in the beginning they didn't really know.
Right.
But yet later they seemed to really say this is what our connection is.
So they started out a small religious company, right? Business, nonprofit type thing. In 72, known as the Christian Arts Center. Which is interesting because they taught a lot of metaphysics and theosophy and astrology, right? So the name probably doesn't fit very well.
Well, remember this was the 70s. There was a religious movement happening in America in the 70s. We keep talking about cults that did stuff in the 70s because there was a lot of that happening right then.
Yeah, true.
Some people call it a revival. Some people call it a... I can't think of the term, but a devolving of the faith.
Right.
But either way, they all agree that there was things happening. Whether it was the Holy Spirit moving or it was Satan moving or a combination of both, things were happening in America at that time, very actively. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of churches founded, a lot of cults founded, a lot of spirituality movements, a lot of stuff was happening in America at that time. So this wasn't that uncommon of a thing.
Yeah, but it's hard to claim that theosophy is Christian at all, right?
I'm not claiming it's Christian. I'm just saying.
So to have called themselves the Christian Arts Center and be teaching these things, there's a bit of a disconnect already, right? I think Applewhite probably had some hand in the naming, right? With the intention of being more on the Christian side of things, which might explain why they failed just a short while after it opened. And then they eventually started another place called the No Place, KNOW. Same kind of thing, except they focused much more heavily on the theosophy. And it closed in 1973. So within a span of a year and a half or so, they've opened two businesses and closed two businesses as business partners.
And, they always refer to themselves as partners. And Doe often referred to T, so Applewhite referred to Nettles as his elder member.
Right.
The other thing they put together, we'll talk about this more in the theology, but it's important for the history too, that later he referred to himself as the equivalent of Jesus and her as the equivalent of the Father. So the reason I bring that up is is that he's seen her as higher than him, even though they were partners. They also express themselves as the two witnesses in Revelation. And so it's important to just say, that, you know, he thought of her as above him. I also seen an interview where they talked to her daughter, because she had a daughter when they met.
Right.
And she mentioned that, you know, she thought her mother had a lot of influence on Applewhite. So that's interesting. I parallel that with a previous cult we talked about, Susan and Tony Alamo. Really Susan was kind of in charge in the beginning, at least.
Yep. And then Susan passed, and then Tony went even further downhill, which is kind of pretty similar to what happened here.
Yes, we're gonna get to that in the history.
Yeah. So after this business closed, this no place, Bonnie and Marshall decided to travel the U.S. So they loaded up in his it was a Mustang, if I remember right. 65 Mustang. Loaded up and started just driving around.
They were specifically seeking,
exploring the world,
what their purpose was going to be.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of the right words to use there. Not necessarily their word from God, but they're specifically trying to seek. She kept telling him that they had a higher purpose and they were seeking to what that would be.
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear exactly where they found that.
Well, actually, the Pacific Northwest is where they made the final connections, right, in 1974. They met another woman who was pretty heavily into metaphysics, spirituality, astrology, etc. And that woman helped them make the connection, right? They spent 6 months with her after his Mustang broke down. Right, so they went up spending like 6 months with her, and whenever they finally got back in the car, they had their plan, and that's when they started driving more towards. I think they made it all the way to Nashville at one point, just meeting people and proclaiming this message that they were the two witnesses.
Yes, and they equated the Pacific Northwest, because of its arid climate and yet also parts of it being lush, to being the equivalent of Sodom and Egypt.
Right.
Referred to in Revelation. Which, you know, when I first read that, I was like, well, I kind of see where they got that, you know? I don't necessarily agree, but if you were going to call something Sodom and Egypt and look for it based on the part of the world that I know, that kind of makes sense, right? Like, okay, well, there's the arid part, and there's the lush part, and think of all the money we got there, and the stuff that was described in ancient Sodom, and the stuff that was described in ancient Egypt. That's the Pacific Northwest of the United States.
Right. Let's see. Carrying forward, May of 1974, they gave one of their very first followers the Bible that they had been using during their travels, right? They were very, as we get into the theology, right, we'll see this more and more. They kept the Bible at the forefront, right? So it was a little KJV Bible that they were carrying around and reading from and trying to figure things out. And they handed it off to their first follower in 74.
And, you know, we already kind of know the end here, because we've hinted at that, but they were a suicide cult and eventually suicided. And at the very end, there was a reference to this whole Bible thing, because they were not big readers. The whole cult wasn't. They only had a couple of books in the whole house. And the books was a couple of Bibles, two copies of a book they wrote later, or Applewhite wrote later, and that was and one other something else, and that was about it. There just wasn't a whole lot.
Yeah, but they did publish one of their very first statements a year later in 1975, titled Human Individual Metamorphosis. And then they had two more after that, but I don't have the names of those two off the top of my head.
What can you tell us about human individual metamorphosis?
Actually, nothing. I searched for that one, along with their Beyond Human. Is that what it's called? I think it's Beyond Human. I searched for those and couldn't really find it. The earliest statement that I can find was from 1988, I think. So a few years later. And that one's got a lot in it. A lot to pull from a theology section.
Well, later on, they made quite a few public statements that we can get, but their earlier stuff is harder to find. Mm-hmm. I think they were kind of refining what they were doing still a lot back then.
Yeah.
They were not as public as some other cults have been.
Right.
They actually did not do a whole lot of trying to get followers and things.
Nope, not until after 88.
But they just are we about to the first meeting?
Just about. Yeah, they had what they were doing while they were traveling around is they had this little pamphlet, right? And talking about how I think it was as simple as more like a business card that just says the two witnesses are here, be prepared, right? And they were going around to churches and just leaving it on pulpits.
And, you know, that's another thing that makes them a unique versus some other, mm-hmm. is that they often left a lot of details unsaid, a lot of things unsaid. They did not fill in a lot, even for their own followers. They would get a follower, and they would tell them pretty much the things they had just told them already. They didn't have anything else to add to it.
Right.
There really wasn't a whole lot of, especially in the beginning, there wasn't a, okay, do this or do that. It was just, hey, we're the two witnesses.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot to it. It took them quite a while to build that. By the time they built that, they already had a bunch of followers, which mm-hmm. makes it more baffling why these people followed them off of so little. But if you hear these people talk, they built a deep spiritual connection off of what seemingly is very little.
Right. Yeah, because by 2 years of them traveling around, they had nearly 200 followers within the first couple of years of traveling around. I mean, it's crazy. Now, by the 80s, the vast majority of those had left, but they gathered up quite a bit pretty quick.
Well, they gathered the most during the meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that first meeting kind of occurs right here in this first couple of years time span.
So the first meeting, they rented a room at a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
I think they put an ad in the paper saying they were going to have this meeting. And they were going to talk about themselves being the witnesses, talk about aliens. They mentioned aliens specifically in that. And that they were aliens and were going to talk to people. And a bunch of people showed up. I want to say it was like 400 people showed up.
Yeah, it was a lot.
I didn't write down the exact number. I should have written that number down. But it was quite a lot. The local news media covered it. You know, oh, look at these crackpots, you know. But 100-something people disappeared from that little town that day.
Mm-hmm.
They got up and followed them. But here's the problem. They weren't really ready for this. They didn't,
of course not.
They didn't really have a place to go. They just sort of went out into the woods.
Yeah. They had been living in another car for a while.
Yeah, they weren't ready for this. They actually told some of their followers, okay, meet us at so-and-so. And then when they got there was a messenger left. Okay, no, meet us at another place. Okay, go meet us at another place. They finally met them out in a national park, and they camped out there, and they spent time with them and they taught them. But again, they didn't have much of a theology built yet. So they didn't teach them a whole lot. That was still pretty early. They're like, oh, now we got these people convinced. And these people were willing to step away from their families and their family ties. And like a lot of other cults, part of the way they financed it was these people sold all their possessions and gave the group what they did have. And all worked together. Anything they did end up working or doing, they would give to the group.
Yep.
So they weren't necessarily really rich, but the group survived off of the people working together and putting it all in one. Commune kind of style. But they didn't even have a big commune to start. They literally had nothing in the beginning. This reminds me of when we talked about... or have we talked about... Charles Manson?
No, not yet.
We haven't done Charles Manson yet. We didn't do Charles Manson. This reminds me how Charles Manson...
This is only our fifth cult to do so far.
Yeah. This reminds me of Charles Manson, though. When we talked about Charles Manson, they were basically homeless, but had a bunch of famous friends.
Right.
But that's how they started. Like, and there was another article in the news about how it was like 100-something people disappeared from this town all of a sudden.
Yep, just got up and walked away.
They got a lot of press over that. A lot of press. And this really upset, especially Applewhite. The daughter even mentioned, you know, letters from her mom talking about the press and stuff and how the press didn't do things right. And it wasn't too long after this, they ended up in Texas.
Yep. Made it back to Houston.
And as you said, they had quite a few followers. But they were not... Now, a lot of cults have a thing where if your followers... They don't let followers leave. But they never had that sort of policy. Their policy was, follow us, okay. Don't follow us, bye.
Right.
It is said that often when followers did leave, they gave them a bus ticket or even a plane ticket. Gas money. A way to get back home. They didn't necessarily give them their possessions back. But... Right. They did not hold them hostage like some other cults have done. Jim Jones was known to take away the passports.
Right. Take away the passports and
move them to the rainforest. And...
Right. But they were not like families. That. And that's part of one of the reasons that some people would say that Heaven's Gate isn't a cult by some definitions, which is one of the reasons we did the episode before this where we revisited what is a cult.
Right. Yep. So moving forward a couple of years, 1985. Nettles dies.
Yes.
She dies of liver cancer.
They were in Dallas by then.
Yep.
Which was interesting because her daughter, who was grown at this point but still quite young, was also in Dallas. But they were not seeing family. But while they weren't seeing family, she wrote her daughter fairly regularly. And she didn't know her mom was dead, was sick even, until some other members wrote her and told her that her mom had passed away. And there was kind of a falling out between her and Applewhite because he did not call her or tell her or write her or anything about it. And he later apologized to her for that because he said he was so heartbroken that he couldn't do it. But it was even more heartbreaking when she figured out that she lived in the Dallas area and her mom was in the Dallas area and she didn't know idea. Her mom was going and getting treatment at the hospital. And she died of cancer, I believe.
Yep, liver cancer.
Yeah. And this just rocked the world for Doe. See, before this, they had been teaching... That, we hadn't gone into the theology yet, but they had been teaching that they were all going together.
Right.
And we'll get more into that in the theology side, but they've been teaching all go together. So then all of a sudden this changed. And again, this mirrors what we've seen with the Tony Alamo stuff, where they'd been teaching one thing. And then once she died, now we got to come with a different answer.
Right. Yeah, because they had, again, like I said, we'll get to it in the theology. You know, they had been. Right up in the early 80s, they had been teaching that Doe and T were going to be murdered, right? But then rise again 3.5 days later, just like the witnesses in Revelation. And then that didn't happen, but then Nettles died of liver cancer. So it just, it kind of threw everything into a moment of question, right? And so it wasn't until 3 years later that Doe wrote the 1988 update statement, right? And published that and made it available for the world.
This is where he really started fleshing out what their theology was going to be.
Right. Yep. Yeah, he had spent, I guess, likely he had spent this 3 years laying everything out and making sure that he understood it before that he put it out there for the world.
In the meantime, the members started getting very invested in technology.
Mm-hmm.
Some members that had come later on had already been involved in technology, but some learned it in the cult. And let's remember, nowadays, a lot of people work in technology. And you and I are, it's right. well known, we're in DFW area. There's a lot of technology stuff here and a lot of other people. It's, we could go to the grocery store and find somebody else who works in IT, you know?
Yep.
Here. But that wasn't the case even here back then. That right. was the case in Silicon Valley in Northern California. And they started getting more and more into it. They even started a company, Higher Source, where they did web design, programming jobs, system design, a lot of different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually moved themselves to a couple of different places. They moved out to the Southeast, which kind of makes sense. And then they eventually moved into Northern California. Not, and right. I'm not talking about expansion here. You know, in other groups, we may be talking about they expanded to this place and that place. You know, yeah, Jim Jones, they kind of expanded. They just got up and moved. Their group actually got smaller over time. And so they could move together. It was still a large group. Mm-hmm. But they could move together.
Yep. So it was kind of in that time into between 88 and 96. They had a moment of intense marketing, proselytization, telling the world about Doe and T, right? There was a lot that was going on trying to get attention onto them. I say a lot. It was really in two big bursts, right? In 88 and then in 96, there was a big burst. All the while they were doing these websites and systems and things on the side.
Well, and I don't know about the word intense. A lot of other cults and even legitimate religious movements would go out and knock on doors or go out on street corners and stuff, and this was not really their style.
Right, true.
They did some talking to people, but they were weird, and they knew they were weird. I mean, seriously, right. They had the computer geek weird, and then they had the cult member weird.
Right.
And they took weird to a whole new level. If y'all Google these folks, you'll find videos of them. They were weird, and they knew this. So they tried to use the digital medium. They did a lot of this with websites and issuing mm-hmm. press release type things and stuff. Also, it's important to note that during this same time, there was a lot of clashes with the federal government and religious groups in America.
Right.
Waco comes to mind, Ruby Ridge, mm-hmm.
CSA.
The CSA that we covered previously, stuff like that was happening. They were watching this. And remember, part of their theology is about with, you know, being persecuted. And mm-hmm. they expected the government would persecute them. I think it was frustrating to them that they really weren't persecuted because they really weren't a threat of anything or even a perceived threat. They even discussed, maybe we should go buy guns so the government will come after us. They never did such a thing.
Right.
But it came up. That Sawyer claimed that discussion had come up. Sawyer's a former member. He was very likely to listen to this and respond, so that'll be interesting.
I was going to say former?
he had left the group, the class, right before things had happened. He's still loyal to Tiendo. But y'all can Google him too. We'll put some links in the show notes there.
Yep.
Y'all know y'all can run. I say we. Matt didn't do any of that. Brian does all that work, just so y'all know. If Matt did it, it wouldn't get done. So, although, Brian, I did give you some links in my notes here, if you care to use any.
I saw that. Thank you. I appreciate that. I've only got about 30 in my bibliography. So,
but anyways, so they seen that. They were secluded from culture in some extent. Like, they were not the type to be out and about a whole lot, but they did go out as groups. Again, and we'll go more into that in the theology and sociology about how they did that.
Yeah.
But my point is, they were worried about the government and during this same period of time, and they thought there would be some conflict with the government that never really materialized. So as you said, intense, but the truth is, most folks still hadn't heard about them. They made the news once or twice for very small things, but for the most part, they were an unknown.
True. Perhaps looking at it from the outside in, if I remember right, that idea comes from one of their own releases or statements about their history and things that they had been doing, and they used the word intense.
Mm.
So for them, it probably would have been considered intense.
They were very emotionally non-expressive people.
Right.
So that is interesting that they would use such a word like that.
Beyond. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've reached March 26, 1997.
Okay. So March 26, 1997. At this point, there are 39 members.
Down from the several hundred from in the early 80s.
Yes.
Down to 39.
They are living in a mansion in Northern California, that's rented.
Mm-hmm.
They have previously decided that the part of their theology that we'll talk about is that they think they're going to be taken up into a spaceship and graduate to the level above human.
Mm-hmm.
The evolutionary level above human. And they think that there is a spaceship behind the Hale-Bopp Comet, Hale-Bopp Comet, driven crew by T, who is to the eye previously. In preparation for this, for them going up, they went on a spree of a little bit.
This one, we'll talk more about this in the sociology, okay. But yes, they did go out, right? One of the testaments, right? One of the exit letters, right? Of one of the guys talks about this spree, right? And he explains that yes, they all went out, right? They went to do these things that had previously brought them joy, only to find that none of it really mattered.
Yes.
And that they had gotten beyond that. So they did. They went to Vegas. They went to... you had some other places listed. Where else did they go?
Oh, they went to the San Diego Zoo.
The zoo, yeah.
They went to Mexico. Went to Tijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was the sociology or history? I'm going to bring it up here. Leading up to this, several of the male members went to Tijuana and had themselves castrated.
Mm-hmm.
Including Doe. They lived a life free of any sexual relations, and so that made it easier for them. But yeah, they went around, they did some things. It's important to note they were good neighbors. And that they were running their business quite a bit at this point. And we'll talk later more about the business, but they had some pretty hefty clients at that point that was significant. They were not poor people.
Right.
They were not millionaires, but they were making things happen. And seemed to live a monastery type life. They had plenty of money, but they didn't spend a lot of money.
Mm.
They lived very simply. And they even referred to it as that type of lifestyle.
Yeah.
But then they decided the day had come. And they organized a plan. They were very carefully planned people. This was not like Jim Jones, where it was, okay, the emergency's here. Let's do it. Let's do it. Jim Jones planned, right. But this was even more meticulously planned. They helped each other. They took a mixture, or they took a drink with some barbiturates, which was fairly popular in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing not hard to get, and some applesauce. They said it could have been pudding or applesauce. It was something like that. They mixed it together. They washed it down with some vodka. And they all put on their same uniform. Because they believed they were going to be a crew on a spaceship. They all put on their same uniform. I'm not sure why, but they all put $5.75 in their pockets. A $5 bill in three quarters. They lay down. And they did it in shifts of 15. It was ships of 15, right. And 8 or 9 at a time helped them, tied a bag around their head, and slowly suffocated to death. But they didn't struggle because they were so, you know, they poisoned themselves previously.
Mm-hmm.
Of note is that Doe was not the last one to die, nor the first. He was among the last, but somebody helped him. He was quite aged at this point. Wasn't he in his 70s by the end?
60s or 70s, yeah. He was getting up there.
You see pictures of him, and he did not look well.
Right.
Matter of fact, none of them looked well. They ate very simply. They were not poor, but they didn't eat a whole lot. They all wore loose, baggy clothing, so you couldn't tell much about them. They all had their hair cut very short. Right before they did this, they had some members leave. But they were still friendly with some who left. And they wrote a letter to a member. And when he came by to check on them, as was asked to do in the letter, actually, this was Sawyer. He went by to check on them, as asked in the letter, and he found that they were all inside the place dead. He left, and he called 911, originally anonymously. And said what he had found, and then later he admitted it was him that called 911.
Oh, I didn't realize it was him that had called them.
Yes.
Hmm.
I believe that was it. And then they were really in the news. They wanted to be in the news, and now they were really in the news.
Now they were.
The government really didn't come after them at that point.
Yep.
Probably fits in right here in this part. I know we're wrapping up the history part here. Is that the government ended up auctioning off their assets to pay for the cleanup.
Right.
Which I found very interesting.
Well, cleanup and autopsy and a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, it's expensive to die.
It's true. When it probably costs the taxpayers a lot. 39 or 40
people to die all at once.
How do you dispose of all the bodies?
Right.
Yeah, and they didn't have a whole lot of assets. They had a little bit of cash. It was described they had some money in the bank. It's not clear if that was recovered or not. They kept a very careful ledger. Some interesting things I see was that they had found some money while they were in Vegas, and they were really excited about that. And at some point, they gave $2 to a homeless person on the street. But they kept that in their ledger, every single dollar and penny they spent.
Mm. It's crazy. So there's not any. Well, I don't know. This is one of those lines that I wrote down. I think I wrote it early on that there's not really any active members of Heaven's Gate. But I don't think that's right.
No.
I think that there are still quite a few followers out there. I say quite a few. I mean, there's at least two, right?
I think there's between 3 and 5.
Yeah.
At
least.
It's a little unclear.
They're publicly following.
Yeah. So tell us why you think there are followers out there.
Well, you're the one who sent me Sawyer, right? His Twitter page that's quite a bit about Heaven's Gate.
So Sawyer's a follower who, the one that talks in the news about finding the bodies and stuff. He is somebody who left, and I looked into that. Sawyer left because he could not abide by the no sexual relations rule.
Right.
He just couldn't get out of his mind, and he says that he tried. And I'm talking about stuff that he talked about. He gave, you know, written or video testimony about, mm-hmm. and he couldn't. And he went to Doe, and Doe tried to help him, and he just couldn't, so he left. And he says he regretted that decision later on. He had actually, I think he had entered the group with his girlfriend originally. I'm not sure 100% on that.
Yeah, I haven't dug into his story very much.
But then there's also, I don't want to steal your thing here. Are you wanting to bring up the other part?
Well, I was going to say, their website is still very much active, right? It's being paid for. It's being run on a modern hosting platform.
But it looks totally out of the 1997.
It looks like it came straight from 97, right? I'll make sure that I link it in the blog post if and whenever I get to write that. It's going to be a long week. But you reached out to them and you sent me an email early this morning, like 8:30, where they responded to you.
Yes, I asked them about ordering a copy of the book, which I'm definitely going to be doing. I asked them about ordering a copy of the book, a physical copy, which mm-hmm. apparently you can still get. It's not up on any of the digital places. It's not on Amazon. But you can order a hardback copy from them. The website says it's $45. When I emailed them and asked them how to order it, they told me send $30 in cash to their P.O. box. So maybe I'll get scammed to $30, but maybe not. I'm going to send them some money and let's see what happens.
There you go.
I'd like to have a copy for my collection.
Right? We're going to have the awesome collection of cult memorabilia.
Right?
Oh, dear. Yeah. So there's at least two, probably a third person in the mix somewhere. Sawyer mentions a couple of people on his Twitter page, a couple of handles.
And I think those people that he mentions are the ones who are probably running the website.
Right.
It's not known exactly who runs the website, but it's thought to know. It's thought that they know who they are. They have said they don't really give interviews much, but they do answer questions if you email them. Some questions. They have said that they were asked specifically to not go with the 39, to leave, go out, and to stay behind, and that they are okay with that. So they're still believers. They're still employed. And that they were asked to stay. Sawyer seems to kind of have some sort of grievance with these folks back and forth. There's also another person who's in the documentary that was released on HBO Max just earlier this month. This is July of 2022. who talks about being a former member, and he did go in with his girlfriend at the time. And so there's other members too. So there's between 3 and 5 members left who still mm-hmm. believe in the message T&O preached. And believe that at some point, they're coming back and to give people another chance to go with them. They also believe that at some point, T will recycle the earth. So this is why Doe was telling people this is their last chance to leave before the earth is recycled. Again, talking about imagery from Revelation.
Yep. Well, Matt, I think that covers the history. And kind of leads us towards theology. So we decided this week or this month that we're gonna try something a little bit new, and we're gonna split this up into 3 different episodes, right? Because we know sitting through a 3-hour podcast can be a little bit daunting, and with as much as we have to talk about with these guys, it might bump us into the 3-hour mark. There's a lot here on the theology side.
We're already at 47 minutes, sir.
I know, right? So, good night, and we will talk to you guys next week. We will be back.
Thank you for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Don't forget that we have our website, faithfraudsfalsehoods.com, where we post a more detailed blog with references so that you can go and take a look at all of this information for yourself. Also, remember to share this with a friend and help us get the word out there for everyone else. We'll see you in the next one.